This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When asked what she does for a living, Elizabeth Pisani sometimes answers sex and drugs. The more precise answer is that she's an epidemiologist who has spent years investigating the spread of the AIDS epidemic. She's provided research, analysis, and policy advice to UNAIDS, the World Health Organization, the World Bank, and the Centers for Disease Control. Her new book is called The Wisdom of Whores, Bureaucrats, Brothels, and the Business of AIDS. As we'll hear later, one of the subjects she writes about is President Bush's program PEPFAR, an acronym for the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief. President Bush described it as a work of mercy to help the people of Africa. But the financial aid comes with strings attached that Pisani says reflect a moral agenda, not an epidemiological one. Elizabeth Pisani, welcome to Fresh Air. Just give us a brief overview of the work that you've done as an epidemiologist working on the AIDS epidemic around the world.
Well, most of my work has been focused on trying to help governments understand how the HIV virus is spreading in their countries. And in the countries that I've worked in, which are mostly in Asia, so Indonesia, in China, in East Timor, in the Philippines and other countries, that means spending a lot of time hanging out in brothels because we work a lot with commercial sex workers and men who buy sex, also with gay men in nightclubs and injection drug users. So I spend a lot of time having very late nights.
Give us an example of something you learned about how AIDS was spread by sex workers in one of the countries that you work in that you wouldn't have known had you not really been there on the ground talking to people directly.
We always have this assumption that sex workers have huge numbers of partners. And when we were talking to some of the sex workers in Jakarta, the capital of Indonesia, where I worked for many years, they actually reported very low numbers of partners. And in fact, that taught us more about the science than it did about the sex work itself, because I was sitting around, in fact, one evening with one of the transgender sex workers, and we were chatting and drinking, and she was knocking back my very best whiskey. And I was like, Ines, you've got expensive tastes. How do you support that on 3 clients a week? And she said, what do you mean 3 clients a week? And I said, well, that's what you're telling us in your surveys. And she said, nah, you're talking to all the dogs. And I said, no, we're not. We're doing random selection, very by the book, great epidemiological surveys. And she said, nah, you're talking to all the dogs. And I was like, you're not listening to me, Ines. We do these random. And she interrupts me again and says, no. Any sex worker who's talking to a research team is a sex worker who's not with a client. So you're talking to all the dogs. You're talking to the ones who are not with clients. And therefore you're getting, she didn't put it this way, but you're biasing your estimates downwards. And in fact, as a result of that, we changed the way that we did our samplings and we got much higher reports of clients later on. So you learn a lot from being on the ground and chatting to the people that you're working with.
What did you change?
What we did was we actually worked with the structures. The transgender sex trade is very, very interesting. It's very well structured, and it has a structure that almost exactly mirrors the government structures of Indonesia. So you have a provincial head, a district head, and then a head for each of the sub-districts, and they organize the girls and all of the girls, I call them, transgender sex workers, and all of them are very careful to work in a hierarchy and do what the district head says. So we started working with the district heads in the transgender community, and they gathered people during the daytime when we weren't interrupting with working hours to their houses, and we were able to do the surveys there. So not only did it make it easier for the transgenders because we weren't interrupting their work, but it also made it easier for my research team because we didn't have to be on the streets at 2:30 in the morning, subject to police raids, for example. It's very embarrassing when your whole survey team gets taken away by the police because they're accused of being sex workers.
Right. You write in your book that the AIDS epidemic in Africa is different in how it's spread than the AIDS epidemic in most other countries. What's different about Africa?
Essentially, there are two epidemics in the world. One is, as you say, in East and Southern Africa particularly, and one is in all of the rest of the world. So the United States looks more like Indonesia, looks more like Argentina, looks more like Kyrgyzstan than it does like any African nation. The difference is this, that in most of the world, HIV is spread mostly in behaviors that are fairly well defined as high risk, and that is among people who buy and sell sex, among gay men who have many partners, and among people who inject drugs. In Africa, because of different patterns of sexual behavior, HIV spreads among men and women in the general population. And the different patterns of sexual behavior are this. It's not a volume question. It's not Africans have more sex. It's that they have sex in different patterns. And that is, they're more likely to have two or three partners at any given time, in any given six-month period, than people in other parts of the world. People in other parts of the world may have the same number of partners overall, or probably more over the course of a lifetime, but they tend to have them in a string, in a serial monogamy pattern. So I call it sex in nets versus sex in strings. Why is that important? Because HIV is actually not very infectious. So it's a virus that, once it gets into your body, replicates very, very, very quickly. And there's lots of virus hanging around in your body. And for that period, you are highly infectious. But that period only lasts for a maximum of 2 or 3 months. Some would say up to 6 months maximum. And then you start making antibodies, and it controls the amount of HIV that's in your body and that can easily be passed on. And that phase can go on for a very long time, but you're not in that phase, not very infectious. So the likelihood that you spread HIV essentially depends on how many partners you have in that first very infectious period.
You're of two minds when it comes to President Bush's AIDS funding program in Africa. You're very supportive and upbeat about the treatment aspects of the funding, the funding that's used for treatment programs, but you're very critical of how the funding is used for prevention.
The progress that has been made on treatment has been absolutely astonishing worldwide. And it's really because the United States and President Bush, through this PEPFAR program, as it's called, upped the ante. When we first made the estimates of how much it would cost to beat this thing worldwide, we didn't even put treatment into the equation because everyone just thought, it's just never going to happen in Africa. We can't even be dreaming of it. And 3 or 4 years later, the United States government said, why shouldn't we be thinking of it? Of course we can think of it, and put the money on the table. And it changed everything. And that's been absolutely wonderful and really made a dramatic difference to the lives of now close to 3 million people who are living with the virus and who are now able to access treatment. But the more treatment you have, the more prevention you need, because it increases the size of the epidemic by keeping people alive for longer. So we really need to refocus on prevention. But the money that has been provided through PEPFAR is peculiarly ineffective for prevention because of the restrictions that have been placed on it. And those are the following. Of the money that's earmarked for prevention, a third of it has in the past been earmarked for abstinence-only programs. Now, abstinence-only programs have been heavily funded in the United States, and they've been shown not to work even in the United States. Of the teenagers who take an abstinence pledge, who actually stand up in public and say, I will abstain from sex until I'm married, we have a failure rate of at least 72%. That's among the people who actually take the pledge. Forget about those who don't. Why we think that those programs would be any more effective in East and Southern Africa than they are, or anywhere else in the world, than they are in the United States, I've never been able to fathom. The second restriction, which is a very important one, is on working effectively in the commercial sex trade. there's a the United States government in the moment takes an abolitionist view to the sex trade. The only way to deal with prostitution is to wipe it out entirely. Now, many of us believe that that's not a feasible answer, and that what we need to do is to increase health and safety conditions for workers and for clients in the sex trade. But we can't do that effectively with PEPFAR money. It's not allowed.
In fact, in countries that take AIDS funding for prevention from the United States, they have to sign a pledge. What does the pledge say?
The pledge says that we will not, as an organization, or if it's a national government, as a country, recognize commercial sex as an industry or a legitimate activity, and that we will not engage in anything that promotes commercial sex or recognizes it in that way. Now, that makes it very, very difficult to work effectively with sex worker rights organizations. It makes it very difficult to work with the structures of the sex industry. I think I mentioned earlier that some of the most effective programs have been when we work with brothels and when we work with sex workers directly. And you can't do that.
You know, you mentioned that in the Bush-funded program, when it comes to prevention, that the programs have to be abstinence only, and countries and organizations that accept money have to sign an oath saying that they oppose the practice of prostitution and that they have no intention of using any American money for prevention programs related to sex work. How did those...
Excuse me.
Yeah.
Of using any money, not even any American money.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
The
government
is currently
money?
Being sued. Yes. The government of the United States is currently being sued by two organizations who contend that it restricts their freedom of speech because they're not allowed to use even their own money to do those activities.
Well, how do these
unless they sign the pledge.
How do these restrictions end up in AIDS funding from U.S. money?
They were part of a bill that was passed by Congress in 2003, and the restrictions were written into the bill. Now, that bill was passed by a Republican Congress. The bill is now being considered for reauthorization under a Democrat-controlled Congress. Some of the restrictions have been removed. The abstinence-only earmark has been removed, but some have stayed, including the prostitution, anti-prostitution oath. I think that many people are deeply disappointed by that and would like to see that change before the money is actually reallocated.
My guest is Elizabeth Pisani. She's an epidemiologist who has provided research analysis and policy advice to UNAIDS, the World Health Organization, the World Bank, and the CDC about HIV and the spread of HIV. She's the author of the new book, The Wisdom of Whores, Bureaucrats, Brothels, and the Business of AIDS. You know, you write in your book about how politics around the world has so often interfered with the effective prevention of HIV, of the spread of HIV. Give us a couple of what you consider to be the most frequent ways that politics prevents what you would consider to be the best epidemiological ways of preventing the spread of HIV.
The most obvious example is drug injection. The United States taxpayer has funded, at my last count, I think 17 comprehensive reviews of the evidence on harm reduction, and 17 out of 17 have concluded that it is effective and that it is also cost effective. And yet we are still not allowed to use any federal money to provide clean needles to drug injectors. And this is, you know, that's a U.S. thing, but we see it in numerous other countries. We've been fighting very, very hard to get HIV prevention into prisons because we know that people in prisons both inject drugs and have unprotected sex. That's very risky. And people don't want to support that. And when you talk to, I remember talking to a friend in Indonesia who is from Bali, and he was he's been living with HIV for many years now, and he's like, yeah, I remember exactly when it happened. I was in jail, and someone gave us a bunch of we got a bunch of heroin in through one of the guards, and we had one syringe, and so we voted, we designated one guy the injector, and we all lined up. And there were 26 of us lined up, and I was number 23 in the line. And he shot up the first person, and he shot up the second person, and there's blood all over the place. And he rinsed the needle under a dirty tap, and then he shot up the next person and the next person. And then it got to number 12, and I was thinking, all I could think was, please let there be some drugs left. Please let there be some drugs left. He's not thinking, you know, I'm going to get infected with a disease. That needle is disgusting. He's thinking, please let there be some drugs left. And this, my friend Frankie said to me, you know, I can't believe now that I was so stupid, but boy, does addiction make you stupid. Yes, it makes you stupid. But does that mean that we should punish you for being stupid? Or could we possibly try and keep you alive until you stop being an addict? Those very, very pragmatic approaches to addiction and to risky sex are things that are not necessarily supported by the majority of voters and therefore are not supported by the majority of governments.
A lot of people who have AIDS now, and I think this is probably particularly true in developed countries, you know, in countries like England where you live and the United States, a lot of people who have HIV are on the new drugs, and people with AIDS are living living with it as a very difficult but chronic condition as opposed to a life sentence. So how is that affecting, do you think, the spread of HIV and how often people are actually following safe sex practices? You know, now that AIDS isn't the death sentence that it once was.
The effect of this treatment is that we're decoupling the HIV epidemic from the AIDS epidemic. You can live with HIV without ever seeing AIDS. We are now seeing a whole generation of young people, and we're seeing it most obviously in the gay communities in the United States. We're seeing a whole generation of young gay men who have never seen AIDS. So for them, HIV is this sort of slightly mythical thing that they've heard about and they know is supposed to, you know, be horrible. But actually, people are thinking of it almost now as an inconvenience. You take your medicines, you'll be fine. And when you look at the advertising that drug companies do directly to the consumer, and you see the guys who are on AIDS meds and they're all, you know, abseiling down canyons against a sunset or whatever, you think, yeah, it doesn't look so scary.
Now, so how is this affecting safe sex?
Well, we've got quite a bit of evidence from gay communities in industrial countries, including the United States, that condom use is falling and that unprotected sex is rising. Now, people are getting a bit cleverer about who they have sex with, so you're seeing a lot more unprotected sex between people who are already infected. But we're also seeing a rise in unprotected sex between people who don't know the other person's HIV status. And that's really very, very worrying. If we see that same effect in Africa, now that this extremely generous program from the United States and many other countries is increasing treatment dramatically in Africa, then we're going to have a very, very big problem. Because what we're doing is, by getting rid of AIDS through treatment, without getting rid of HIV, we're removing the fear, we're reducing the incentive to stay safe, to adopt safer behaviors. That means more people infected with HIV, and that means even more people who are going to be on these treatments. The treatments are expensive. The price is coming down all the time, but they remain expensive. And because HIV is a virus that replicates very, very, very quickly, it also develops resistance very quickly. We don't know how long these drugs are going to be effective for. So it's really a very, very big risk, both financially and in terms of the ongoing spread of the disease.
So you're looking at a possible nightmare, the dimensions of which we don't know yet.
I would say
a new form of the nightmare.
That's right. And it's a form of the nightmare that no one is talking about.
Well, Elizabeth Pisani, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Elizabeth Pisani is the author of the new book, The Wisdom of Whores, Bureaucrats, Brothels, and the Business of AIDS. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. She got her start on the soap opera As the World Turns, but Julianne Moore is famous for her roles, often edgy roles, in independent films like Shortcuts, Safe, The Big Lebowski, Boogie Nights, Magnolia, Far From Heaven, and I'm Not There. She made her film debut in the 1992 thriller The Hand That Rocks the Cradle. In 2003, she received two Oscar nominations, one for her performance in The Hours, the other for Far From Heaven. Now she's starring in the new film Savage Grace, which was adapted from the nonfiction book by Barbara Daly about Barbara Daly Bakeland. Bakeland entered the elite social world when she married Brooks Bakeland, the heir to the Bakelite plastics fortune. But when their marriage fell apart, so did her life and her son's life. This is a story of social climbing, jealousy, incest, and madness. Here's a scene from early in the film, set in Paris in 1959. The marriage has soured, and Barbara's social attentions are focused more on her son than her husband. Barbara is having lunch in the park with her son, talking about their privileged lives and comparing it to the life she was brought up in by her mother, who she refers to as Ninny.
Some people's fathers, some people's mothers, they have to go to an office or a factory or a store, I guess, every day. But we are fortunate. Because what we do is what we love. What does Francois's father do?
He works.
We worked. I mean, father worked. Nini worked. There was no other way. I kind of had to raise myself, and then I worked too, at Filene's. And then when I could, I left. I just left. Nini wanted what was best for me. Only what was best for me. Find the man, she'd say. She meant man, I guess, and she meant money. The rich, they don't have pet names for money.
Julianne Moore, welcome back to Fresh Air. Let me ask you to describe Barbara Bakeland, the character that you play, who was a real person. What's your take on her?
Yeah. She was from the wrong side of the track, so to speak, you know, in terms of these society people. She came from Boston with her mother. She came to New York City to marry somebody, to find a rich husband. And she she dated lots of sort of society people, and then went to Hollywood for a screen test, where, interestingly enough, she discovered that she didn't want to be an actress because it was too hard. She didn't want to work. You know, she really wanted, this is somebody who definitely wanted glamour and society and fame and attention without anything underneath it. You know, I mean, I think that was probably her greatest tragedy in her life, was that it was all kind of her pursuits were sort of, you know, hollow. But it didn't make her any less human. She was also kind of passionate and alive and engaged and narcissistic and difficult. And I mean, you know, she was sort of people would say about Barbara, like, in one breath they'd say how she was the life of the party, but then they never wanted to have dinner with her ever again. She was that kind of person.
I think one of the interesting things about your performance is Barbara Bakeland had gone to Hollywood, you know, wanting to be an actress, and then, as you've said, just didn't want to have to do the work. But the way you play her, she's acting through her life, because she's
constantly, she's
not a person who grew up in society. She's not a person born to money, but she acts like she was. And sometimes that veneer just kind of falls away, and you see the person who she really
you see
is
what's underneath. And she also doesn't, she doesn't act well either. You know, I mean, there are times, you know, she's kind of a sort of a poser. And I even tried in the performance, because the movie takes place in these little kind of these vignettes at the very beginning in the 40s. I wanted my speech to have a quality more like old movies.
Yes.
You know, more like she was copying the way she thought she should speak. By the time we get to the 70s, her speech becomes much more relaxed and more sort of the time or whatever.
Savage Grace is an independent film. You've had, like a lot of people now, you've had a dual career in more commercial films and more independent films.
Yeah.
And in your independent films, you've done some pretty risky material. And you seem to, in fact, gravitate to movies about extreme characters, or, you know, movies that take risks with their subject matter. Let me play a great scene that you're in the movie Magnolia, and this is one of Paul Thomas Anderson's films. And in this film, you're married to a character played by Jason Robards. He's very sick, and he's dying.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he has a prescription for liquid morphine that you've been getting for him. And in this scene, you go into a pharmacy, you get a prescription filled, and you want to set up the scene for us?
I'm going to get a prescription filled, and I attack the pharmacist because I think he thinks that I'm, you know, that I'm a junkie, that I'm a drug addict, and he doesn't treat me with the kind of respect that I think I deserve as somebody who is taking care of a dying man. I'm saying you don't know who I, you know, you don't, basically it's you don't know who I am just by looking at me. Don't think you know who I am.
So you're getting the morphine and other heavy-duty drugs at the pharmacy, and
yeah.
the pharmacist comments that this is strong, strong stuff. And he says
yeah.
to you, what exactly do you have wrong with you that you need all this? And that's mm-hmm. when you really erupt. Here's the scene.
That's when, yeah.
I come in here, you don't know me, you don't know who I am, what my life is, and you have the balls, the indecency to ask me a question about my life? You two! Don't you call me lady! I come in here, I give these things to you, you check, you make your phone calls, look suspicious, ask questions, I'm sick! I have sickness all around me, and you ask me my life? What's wrong? I'm using death in your bed, in your house! Where's your decency? And then I'm asking questions. What's wrong?
That's a great scene. That's Julianne Moore
beep,
in
beep,
Magnolia.
Beep.
Yeah, we had a bleep a lot there. Well, you're really unraveling at this point, without getting too deep into the story, explaining why. But one of the interesting things about that scene is that you're doing your lines in an almost musical way, because your hysteria has kind of like taken you out of regular conversation into this world
right.
of almost, you know, music. And at the same time,
right.
you have this very dramatic music behind you. Did you know what
uh-huh.
the music behind you would be, that would be mm-hmm. a counterpoint to what you were saying?
Uh-uh. You never know that. You never know how a movie's going to be scored. That's one of the weird things about seeing a film when it's completed, is that you don't know how it's going to be edited, you don't know how it's going to be scored, you don't know how the color timing is going to work. It could be brighter, it could be darker than what you thought. So, you know, it's not an actor's medium. You're really in the hands of the director in terms of how the performance kind of is shaped. There have been times when I felt like I've been in stuff that's overscored, and I'm like, oh no, oh gosh, you know. I didn't feel that way with this. I think it was a beautifully scored movie, so I think I really liked it.
Over the years, you've played a lot of characters who have their moments of breakdown, hysteria, or they're just sobbing. Have you
yeah.
developed different ways of sobbing depending on who your character is?
Yeah, you have to, because they're all different people. You know, one of the questions that I get a lot is, you know, how do you make yourself cry? Or do you know, people say, do you think of something? Do you... And I can't make myself cry. Only the character can make me cry. She has to cry. So I have to be in the place where she is, and her circumstances bring me to tears. And hopefully the character then the crying is like her. It's not going to be like me or like some other character that I did. Or, you know, I think there's some characters, I've had some silent criers, I've had some, you know, some wailers and some sobbers and, you know, but it has to be, not to sound all touchy-feely about it, but it has to be the character who kind of presents it to me.
Have you become an observer of the different ways in which people cry or lose control?
Oh, well, you know, the interesting thing about it is it's something that we very rarely see, because people don't like to do it. I was just doing a movie recently where, as usual, I had some crying, and every time I had to do it, I just kind of moan and complain, and I was like, oh, I don't want to. And the director said, why? Because you can do it, and you seem to do it so easily. I said, well, no. I said, because I said, the thing about crying is that's one of the things that we don't like to show people. We don't usually show people that. We usually try to hide it. We're always trying not to cry. So to get yourself, even to get yourself to a character, to a place where you are doing it, is a weird sort of twist to it. You're in an emotional place. You have to allow it to happen because it has to happen on screen. But at the same time, everything in your body is telling you not to do it.
Julianne Moore is my guest, and she stars in the new film Savage Grace. Let me move on to a scene from another film. This is a film also directed by Paul Thomas Anderson, Boogie Nights. Mm-hmm. It's your first film with him. And in this, you're an actress in the porn industry, and your lover and director is played by Burt Reynolds. And Mark Wahlberg plays like the new actor who arrives on the scene.
That's right.
And
is making movies
with you. Yeah, the big star who's very well endowed.
Yeah.
And so in this scene, you're a casting agent at a desk for a porn film, and Dirk Diggler, played by Mark Wahlberg, walks in to audition.
Action, Dirk.
Hello, are you John?
Yes, ma'am.
Your agency recommends you very highly.
Well, I'm a really hard worker, and if you give me a job, I won't disappoint you.
What special skills do you have?
Well, I've been in the Marines for 3 years. I just got back from a tour of duty.
You're kidding.
No, I'm not. And it got really hard being surrounded by all those guys all day.
How long has it been since you've had a woman?
A long time.
That's terrible.
But now I'm back, and I'm ready to pursue my acting career.
Well, as you may or may not know, this is an important film for me. If it's not a hit, I'm going to get kicked out of my apartment. My landlord's a real jerk.
Really?
I see with Julianne Moore and Mark Wahlberg from Boogie Nights. So in this scene, like you're both intentionally being really, you know, amateurish, bad actors.
Right.
So what did you do to...
Well, when you're acting, the idea is basically it boils down to being as realistic as possible in a film. You want to be behaving as people do in real life, which is difficult when you're being observed. But we have, you know, we've learned how to do that. We've learned how to do that by relaxing our bodies and our voices and being connected and being in the moment and looking at somebody. And there's a way that you train yourself to be able to behave that way. Now, if you're not trained, if you're not an actor, if you're not even an instinctive actor, you're not going to know how to speak with inflection. You're not going to know how to move your body and use your voice at the same time. That's something that I do. I never move on a line. Like, I make a movement and then I say the line, which is one of the things that young, you know, people, inexperienced actors do all the time. It's hysterical. So I love that Mark has that. He has a fumble in his line. He goes, I'm a Marine and I just got back. And, you know, he corrects himself midline. We all do that. You know, you always start a line, stop it, start it, whatever. But in this case, you know, because they're just on this little porn movie, they just leave all the mistakes in.
You seem to place your voice higher and in a more uncertain place in that scene, too.
Yeah, I did. I put it over, like, above my, larynx, so it's not connected either. Like, when people are afraid, they can't, you know, they're on top. You know, she's, like, on top of her voice. She's not in her voice because she's not in her body. You know, she's not really present in a way.
Do you have a favorite story from the making of Boogie Nights?
Well, you know, it was funny. I do remember the scene where I give Mark coke for the first time. And at the end of the scene, in the script, it said they embrace. So I'm supposed to, you know, do the coke, do the scene, and my interpretation, give him a hug. And Paul's like, okay, and then you kiss him. And I panicked. You know, I absolutely panicked. I had to do all this stuff with him, you know, all this pulling out of the rubber appendage and him lying on top of me and whatever. But I didn't think I had to kiss him. So I remember thinking, I mean, I was absolutely terrified. It put me in a cold sweat. I did it. It was all fine. And I love Mark. But that was what was so funny to me is that after all that, the thing that really freaked me out, I was like, oh, my gosh, now I've got to kiss him.
Why did that freak you out?
Well, you know, because kissing is pretty intimate. It's probably, I mean, that's a very intimate thing. It's probably more intimate than taking your clothes off in front of somebody in a weird sort of way.
You'd be able to speak about that because in an earlier
film. I've done both.
Yes, yeah. Well, like in Altman's film, Shortcuts,
yeah.
you were
uh-huh.
naked from the waist down in a very dramatic scene. So,
right.
Did you have to
Which
overcome?
Which created quite a furor. I was nervous. You know, I was nervous about it. But Bob, oh my gosh, I loved Bob so much. And he was so kind and so caring. And as far as Bob was concerned, you know, an actor couldn't do anything wrong because he had hired them and therefore they were right, you know. So he just gave you all this latitude. And so I felt very taken care of, you know. I felt, you know, nervous about the scene because it was such a dramatic scene. But he was trying to communicate something that Raymond Carver had written and in a cinematic way. And he did it by kind of peeling off. And that kind of intimacy, that's the way you are physically with somebody in a marriage. That's something that we see with our partners all the time. So he was doing that in that. And so I didn't find it at all salacious. It's certainly not sexual.
So you were never self-conscious about doing that?
Obviously, you know, I'm a little bit, you know, physically self-conscious. You always are. You're always like, oh, okay. But I didn't feel frightened. I felt like it was the appropriate thing in the scene. It wasn't like one of those things where you see an actor having to take their top off and walk across a room. It didn't feel pointless to me. I understood why it was there and how it contributed to the fabric of that scene. So no, I didn't feel challenged by it. But yeah, normal kind of self-consciousness, like, oh gosh, I hope I look okay. Yeah, there's always that.
How did it contribute to the fabric of the scene? Why was it essential?
Because I think, you know, this was a movie where a man was trying to figure out whether or not his wife was having an affair. And in the short story, in Raymond Carver's short story, he's thinking of her. Like, it keeps, you know, you keep flashing back to him seeing her with him, physically with him, or with another man, or doing something. You know, he keeps flashing to these moments of what she looks like physically, her body, while she's, like, doing this kind of mundane stuff in the house. So Bob was trying to find a way to have that, put that element in there in a visceral kind of way. So this man is presented with his wife's physicality and her sexuality and her corporalness, I think. And so he said, he was like, this is what's going to happen. And like I said, in a way, it's something that happens in a marriage all the time. You're in the bedroom, your husband's out of the shower, and he slowly starts to get dressed, and he's telling you what he's going to do that day. And then you say, well, I have to pick up the kids or I have to do whatever. But you're confronted by each other's bodies and our physicality all the time. So that's what, you know, I think that's what Bob was doing in that. And in a way, I think that is why people were so kind of inflamed by it, because it felt too intimate to them. Because it is. It was an extremely intimate moment.
My guest is Julianne Moore, and she's starring in the new movie, Savage Grace. I want to play another scene from one of your films, and this is from Far From Heaven, which was directed by Todd Haynes, who first directed you in Safe.
That's right.
And more recently, you were in his film about the many different Bob Dylans. I'm not there.
Yeah.
And Far From Heaven is an homage to the 1950s melodramas of Douglas Sirk. Movies like All That Heaven Allows, Imitation of Life, Magnificent Obsession. And in a lot of those films, there's personal secrets, dark secrets, lovers kept apart by close-minded social mores of the
right.
day. And this Far From Heaven has all of that, and it's filmed in those, like, saturated colors of the 50s melodramas.
Yeah.
And in this movie, you're a suburban mother and homemaker in the 1950s, unaware that your husband is a closeted homosexual.
Right.
And you and your African-American gardener, who's played by Dennis Haysbert, who is probably best known for his role as the president on 24, you start to develop feelings toward each other and slowly fall in love. But, of course, it's pre-civil rights movement. You're married. This is a love that cannot be.
That's right.
So here's a scene. Let me play a scene where you and the Dennis Haysbert character are walking through the woods. You're looking at the beautiful flowers and the leaves, and he's looking at a bruise on your face that you got in a fight with your husband.
Oh, look. How lovely.
Did he cause that?
He didn't mean to strike me.
I'm so sorry.
No. Heaven knows we all have our troubles. I'm sure you yourself...
What?
I don't know. Ever since running into you at the exhibition, I kept wondering what it must be like to be the only one in a room. Colored or whatever it was. How that might possibly feel. I'm sure I've never...
Well, I suppose you sort of grow accustomed to it over time. I mean, don't get me wrong. There is a world, even here in Hartford, where everybody does indeed look like me. The trouble is, very few people ever leave that world.
It's a scene from Far From Heaven with my guest Julianne Moore and Dennis Haysbert. Everything in this movie is so heightened. You know, the colors, the birds in the background. Yeah. You're speaking like movie speech. It's not...
Yes.
It's intentionally exactly. Not naturalistic.
Right, right.
Did you go back and watch those 50s melodramas before making the film?
Oh, yeah. I mean, All That Heaven Allows, particularly, was instrumental. I mean, because that's the movie that it most resembles. You know, it's so wonderful sometimes to work in a specific style because there's so much feeling it can hold. You know, you have these rules. There's these conventions about, you know, what all the colors are meaningful. All, you know, the speech is meaningful. The way people move, you know, there's intention in absolutely every moment of it.
So when you were watching the Douglas Sirk movies in preparation for making Far From Heaven, what else did you notice in the film in terms of the style of acting of that genre from the period?
Well, you know, it's interesting because for us, it's easy to make fun of it. It's easy to make fun of that kind of style and that kind of those sort of vocal choices and the you know, but what makes it work and what makes it beautiful in the Sirk films and hopefully in Far From Heaven too is that it's filled. It's that you might have this very stylized way of speaking, but if the emotion is behind it, if it's meaningful, it's very moving because you realize people are not saying what they want to say all the time or they're just trying to communicate another way. So the trick was, and when you watch them, Rock Hudson and Jane Wyman, for example, you realize it's all very deeply felt. Even though the language seems arch or weird, it's meaningful. And that's what kind of makes it beautiful. Like I said, you've got all this content behind the style. And when you have that, I think it's quite powerful.
Now, I know you grew up in a military family. Do you move around a lot as a kid?
Oh, yeah. A lot. You know, I went to like 9 different schools growing up. But, you know, that's not uncommon for an actor. And you find with a lot of actors, if they're not military kids, they're embassy kids or traveling salesman kids or minister's kids. Any of those sort of itinerant upbringing seem to produce actors.
What do you think that is?
Behavior. You know, you learn very, very quickly how to change behavior from place to place. You learn that it's malleable, you know, so who you were was determined by how you were perceived. And as a consequence, I was like, you know, my identity felt really, really fluid. It wasn't until I was an adult, I think, and that I think it takes a long time for any of us to really try to figure out who you are. But I mean, mine was delayed significantly by moving around.
One more question. I know you have a couple of kids who are in school.
Yeah.
I don't know if they're in school plays or not, but do you go to the school plays? I think there's something that's so endearing about watching kids act.
My son, this is unbelievable because he's 10. He's in the 4th grade. They did Macbeth the other day. It was an abridged version. It was, you know, completely, it was abridged, but they all got a part. They picked parts out of the hat. And they performed it. And the clarity was astonishing. There was a line that I heard the Lady Macbeth say that I had never really heard before, where she says, "I would have killed him myself, but he reminded me of my father." And I went, "Huh?" It's like, I didn't know she said that. And here's this little girl. And I just like snapped to attention. It was beautiful. It was really, really beautiful because, and especially with that kind of language, you when you see somebody when you see them communicate to each other that way and try to tell a story, it's quite moving and really authentic.
Did you cry?
Oh, did I? Yeah, I think I probably did. It doesn't take much to make me cry when my kids do things.
Julianne Moore, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Julianne Moore stars in the new film Savage Grace. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tuohy-Westman, Sam Brigger, Patty Leswing, Jonathan Menhivar, and John Sheehan. I'm Terry Gross.